You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 8th of February 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily. We're live here on Monocle 24. This is Emma Nelson. Coming up in the programme, Donald Trump celebrates a strengthening of ties with Egypt. We'll ask what one strong man can teach its apprentice. Also ahead in this week's edition of Tall Stories, it's the glow of the gas lamps. We find out why London's streets are still lit by 200-year-old lights.
Accidents do happen. And although they've been raised a few feet as vehicles have become larger, they still have regular run-ins with London's delivery trucks. If something does get damaged, it has to be replaced with an identical handmade part. This also means that, rather than falling into the category of dying breed, the lamps are on the rise.
And later in the programme...
Live from New York, it's Saturday night!
With Donald Trump now in the White House, we'll find out whether Saturday Night Live's form of comedy and satire has been more relevant or more futile than ever. Plus, a look at the front pages in Asia, and we hear from our tech correspondent who's been chatting to Apple's CEO. All that and more starting right now on The Monocle Daily with me, Emma Nelson. First, though, a quick look at some of the day's other top stories. The International Committee of the Red Cross says it's suspending activities in Afghanistan after six of its workers were killed. It's thought they died in an attack carried out by Islamic State militants. Two other people are accounted for. It's been feared they've been abducted by IS. The Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny has been found guilty of embezzlement. Navalny's lawyer says the conviction will ban him from running in next year's presidential election. Vladimir Putin, who's been in power in one job or another since the end of 1999, is widely expected to run for president again, and his official approving ratings remain well above 80%. Meanwhile, the US President Donald Trump has angrily denounced the three judges who are hearing his travel ban appeal. He's described the process as disgraceful and says it's a sad day for the United States. His comments come a day after an appeals court heard a challenge to the Republican president's policy. It temporarily suspends the US refugee program and bans travel for citizens from seven Muslim-majority countries. And Walt Disney's chief executive has warned that trade wars between the US and China would be bad for business. China's an increasingly important market for the firm's film and merchandise sales. Disney said that its first theme park in mainland China, in Shanghai, was one of its biggest success stories of last year. But there are fears that Donald Trump's protectionist policies could spark off a trade war. Those are the headlines. And welcome to Studio One with me, Emma Nelson, on the Monocle Daily. Now, Donald Trump has heralded a new era of closer ties with Egypt. The American president said that chemistry, among other things, had set the tone for a new era of warmer US-Egyptian ties. Well, let's hear now from our correspondent Ruth Michelson, who's in Cairo. Ruth, explain to us what has happened.
Well, I mean, since Trump's election, Sisi and, well, mainly Sisi, I suppose, and the Egyptian government as a whole have really made a lot of efforts to show how warm they're feeling to the new administration. Sisi and the foreign ministry were both very careful to point out that Sisi was the first person to call Trump to congratulate him on his election. There was a very warm meeting prior to Trump coming to power, and that seems to have been the precursor to Sisi likely visiting Washington pretty soon.
This must be absolutely the best news that Sisi could have possibly imagined.
Well, absolutely, yes. So, I mean, really, you know, it's the most powerful, well, one of the most powerful men in the world now is not going to ask Egypt about its human rights record. And, you know, relations with the Obama administration were famously a little frosty for that reason. And now that's been lifted, and it seems to be, you know, all friends for the time being.
It is an unusual course to take, although nothing strikes us as anything other than unusual in these days, that for so long Barack Obama was focused on the human rights element, and indeed Egypt was that place where the Arab Spring flourished, albeit temporarily. Does this mean that Trump's endorsement of Sisi and the military regime in Egypt effectively shuts the door on human rights by the Trump administration?
That's certainly a good question. It's a question that's on a lot of people's minds. I mean, the Trump administration didn't seem to be very likely to be pressing human rights concerns in any part of the world. And in that sense, you know, Egypt is no exception. But I mean, the Trump administration is certainly heralding about to make some interesting choices. They're apparently mulling at the moment classing the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization, which would make the Egyptians incredibly happy here. But it could also have an impact on things like Islamic charities operating in the US. Could have an impact on a lot of, plenty of US citizens. US citizens that, there are a couple of US citizens currently still imprisoned in Egypt, according to some of the people that I've spoken to. And, you know, those people are accused by the Egyptian government of being associated with the Muslim Brotherhood, whether that's true or not. And so, you know, this would affect the ability to get US citizens out of prison here. It would affect US citizens who have returned to the US after being freed from Egyptian prison, people like Mohammed Sultan, famously. So, this could have a really wide-ranging impact on human rights, not just on the ground in Egypt, but beyond.
Let's talk a little bit, though, about what happens on the ground in Egypt. The fact that this is an endorsement from the outside of effectively the military regime, what does this mean for Sisi's regime and what it can perhaps justify itself in doing now that it has an international backer such as the President of the United States?
Well, absolutely. This is a real shot in the arm for Sisi and the rest of the regime in Egypt. It certainly lifts a lot of the pressure on the government here to even sort of, you know, talk the talk of this is a country that is moving towards democracy. This was one of the demands that was made on Sisi's government after 2013 when Sisi came to power, that the government here constantly justified that it was transitioning towards democracy. And we're not hearing a lot of that kind of talk at the moment, even though, you know, next year Sisi is due to be up for re-election. And currently there's every indication that that presidential election is going to take place. But we're not hearing the same kind of rhetoric that says Egypt is on the path to democracy, or certainly not as frequently as we used to.
Ruth Michelson in Cairo, thank you very much. I'm joined now by Eric Traeger, fellow at the Washington Institute for Near Policy, who's listening to that. Eric, welcome as ever to Monocle 24. What, in your view, is a reason why Donald Trump has embraced Egypt so firmly and so rapidly?
Well, thanks for having me. The Trump administration, and President Trump in particular, sees Sisi as the ideal Arab partner. They see him as a leader who took down an Islamist organization, took down a radical government, has been fighting terrorists on two fronts, you know, in the Sinai as well as in, you know, coming over from Libya in the Western Desert. And this is an administration that sees American priorities in the Middle East as basically being about counterterrorism. So from that perspective, from that security perspective, Sisi is an ideal partner in their view.
It is interesting, isn't it, that in the run-up to Donald Trump taking power, that many warned that he had an inability to embrace the three-dimensional chess that is international relations, and that the fact that he would push for relations with one certain country would mean that he was unaware of the ramifications that could well have with relations with other nations in other aspects. What do you think that Trump's embrace of Egypt will mean for his relationships with other nations in the area?
Well, you know, many of the nations in the area actually looked towards the U.S. relationship with Egypt as a lodestone for how the U.S. deals with allies. So when the Obama administration backed away from Egypt after Mohamed Morsi's removal in July 2013, that very much alarmed the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Israel. I don't agree that this is an example of him not playing, you know, like you said, three-way chess. And I think it's also just important to remember here that when the Obama administration did emphasize human rights, withheld military aid from Egypt for 17 months from October 2013 to March 2015, pending a return towards the democratic process, That didn't work at all. Actually, during that period, Egypt became more autocratic, and it came at the expense of the U.S.-Egyptian strategic relationship. So, look, in a certain sense, Trump has learned some of the lessons of the Obama administration's failed policy towards Egypt. The question, of course, is whether this approach will work, whether embracing Sisi, narrowing the relationship to counterterrorism, will make Egypt a better partner. Egypt has typically been very happy to take American aid, but not so eager to reform its military, to focus more squarely on counterterrorism rather than on sort of big military items. And so that's going to be tested. But, I do think that this administration that has learned some lessons from the previous administration's failures.
And in that context, what are your thoughts on the news that, as Ruth reported a little while ago, that the United States is considering banning the Muslim Brotherhood or turning it into a proscribed terrorist organization?
Well, look, the core challenge there is that the Muslim Brotherhood is an organization in Egypt, but it seems that the attempt to designate the Muslim Brotherhood considers it a single organization and not strictly a national one. And, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood is a global movement comprised of perhaps as many as 70 individual organizations. So it's not clear what it means to designate the Muslim Brotherhood when there are all these organizations, some of which do use terrorism, such as Hamas, but many of which preach hatred, preach bigotry, but fall just short of the legal standard for, designated terrorist groups. So it's not really clear, I think, to many here in Washington what exactly that designation means, whether this is simply going to be a call for the Secretary of State to issue a report on whether the Brotherhood is a terrorist organization. And so today in Washington on this, I think there are just many more questions than answers.
And the fact that Egypt, as we discussed a little earlier with Ruth Michelson, was one of the sites of one of the most vigorous flourishings of the Arab Spring, albeit short-lived. The fact that he has embraced Egypt, does that mean that effectively his any kind of acceptance of the principles of the Arab Spring are no longer relevant to a United States agenda? And if that is the case, what kind of message does that send to other nations?
Well, look, I think the real question is whether the principles of the Arab Spring are first and foremost relevant in Egypt today. I think many Egyptians, and I was just there in December, many Egyptians look at the Arab Spring as a great failure, as having produced chaos and having made their lives less stable. And look, I'm not blaming the uprising for that necessarily. I mean, there were many factors in that, but this is the perception, of course, among many Egyptians today. And so my argument is simply that, whatever a U.S. administration says or doesn't say about the domestic politics of Egypt, ultimately those domestic politics are dictated internally. And if you have a push within Egypt for a new political opening, that ultimately the U.S. is going to be forced to respond to that. I just don't think that we should analyze this as if it's the tail wagging the dog. Ultimately the Arab Spring was something that happened because Egyptians willed it, and were they to will it again, there's no U.S. policy that would stand in the way of that.
Eric Traeger, fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, thank you for joining us on Monocle 24. How much did last month's shooting in Quebec alter Canada's political landscape? We've already been told about Kevin O'Leary, a sort of populist Trump light being trumpeted as the next leader of the Canadian Conservatives. But the businessman with no political experience, instead of being dismissed, is now being touted as a genuine threat to the Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Well, Professor Nelson Wiseman is the director of the Canadian Studies Programme at the University of Toronto, and he joins us from Monocle's Toronto Bureau. Welcome back to the programme, Nelson. It is but, what, 2 or 3 weeks ago since we last spoke, we mentioned Kevin O'Leary, and at the time, there was no great sense that he was any sort of serious threat, either to the creation of a populist uprising in Canada, or indeed a genuine threat to Justin Trudeau. What do you believe may have changed?
Well, he's now in the race. We have to think about how people become leaders of their parties as well as their countries. One of the differences between Canada and the United States is that Donald Trump was successful because you had a first-past-the-post system in the states. So he could win a lot of the states by getting 36, 37, 38% of the vote. The method of electing the conservative leader will be different. It will be a preferential ballot. So although I think there's a fair bit of support for Kevin O'Leary within conservative ranks, and only conservative members can vote, his challenge will be, because he's a polarizing figure, having enough people who will tick him off as second choice or third choice on the ballot. There are 14 candidates. What I would say about if he does become the leader of the party, it would become very much his party, the way the Republicans have become Trump's party. And our leaders, our party leaders, have much more control over their caucuses than the American president, obviously, but also much more control than the Australian or British party leaders. Votes here are almost always strictly on party lines. And everyone falls into place. I think that if we did have an O'Leary as the leader, the prospects for the Conservatives would rely more on how the Liberals are perceived and what Trudeau's popularity is at that time. We just had a poll out yesterday which showed that the Liberals are only leading the Conservatives by 6%, and the Conservatives don't even have a leader. So some of the shine has come off of Trudeau. On the other hand, if you did have a leader like O'Leary, he may have the ability, like Trump has had, to put his foot in his mouth as many times as he can.
There have been observations as well that he's focused on economic growth and jobs. He's positive on immigration. He says he's the son of an immigrant himself. And he's not that bothered about divisive social issues, which is effectively what divides the US political sphere so cleanly in two. There is that element, isn't there, that actually given enough running space, and he has got a lot of running space and time, he's in no rush, that he could actually be a genuine threat to Justin Trudeau. Do you think that is possible?
I agree. And I should point out social conservatism is not nearly as strong a force here in Canada as it is in the United States. Running on jobs and growing the economy, every party runs on that. So if we do have an economic downturn, that would play into the hands of the Conservatives. On immigration, actually, public opinion in Canada is not that much different from the United States, although the Canadian government's policy has been much more liberal, and Canadians generally are more supportive of immigration than are Americans, and I would say Europeans now. But I don't think that would drive the election. I think it would be economy and perception of the leader. One of the reasons the Conservatives lost the last election here in Canada is not because the economy was going down the drain. It was because this perception that the Conservatives and their leader, Harper, had become arrogant and detached and was autocratic. So those things can do you in. And I've always believed that people don't so much get elected as others get defeated. Now the Trump case in the primaries is an exception to that. But then it wasn't one party running against another party. And indeed, in their general election, one could say it was really the Democrats defeating themselves.
Nonetheless, there's we always take the Canadians to be a dreadfully sensible and cool-headed lot. And in the aftermath of the Quebec shootings, my pleasure, in the aftermath of the Quebec shootings, we have seen huge amounts of tolerance rushing out of Canada. Not one of those moments when you think, actually, this is when people batten down the hatches. Plus, on the day that the funerals of those who were killed in that mosque was taking place, Kevin O'Leary uploaded footage of himself at a shooting range. Now, normally, in the cool light of the old world of politics, that would have meant his political end. but it hasn't. So are we possibly looking at a change in temperature or a change in Canadian attitudes full stop, not just because of the immediate circumstances?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, Canadians are not supportive of the kind of loose gun controls they have in the United States. But I don't think many have visited Kevin O'Leary's webpage or the photos he uploads. I'm not familiar with it. I read about it, but I don't think this is getting much attention. As for the shooting in Montreal, I mean, we've had attacks on Muslims and Muslim institutions and mosques around the Western world, in Canada, in the United States, in Britain, in Europe, East and West. So that isn't exceptional. The level of violence here, with, I think, 6 people killed, is remarkable. And, you do have self-radicalized people, radicalized on the left and on the right, around the world. In many of these cases, the perpetrator has some mental health issues. And you can't completely guard against that. This fellow was a political science student. He was visiting extremist sites online and also posting some things. But there are many, many, many people who do such things, and we can't monitor all of them. So perhaps this is part of the new normal, because we live in an age where there is more of a clash, I don't like to use the word, of cultures, of civilizations, of our societies are much more diverse than they were 40, 50 years ago. And we see this in all Western societies.
Professor Nelson Wiseman from the University of Toronto, live from our bureau in that very city. Thank you very much for joining us on Monocle 24. Stay with us, because in a moment we'll hear why Norway's budget airline is doing more business than SAS.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Our very own Monocle Library is growing into a robust collection of well-turned-out titles. For an in-depth look into our core theme of quality of life, why not delve into our first-ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living? For any would-be business leaders, entrepreneurs, or even established companies in search of fresh ideas, there's The Monocle Guide to Good Business. In How to Make a Nation, a Monocle Guide, we look at the small and the big things that can help make our nations work better. And in The Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining, we bypass the foam and the fuss to uncover the makings of a truly great meal. Monocle's handsome books are published by our friends at Gestalten in Berlin and offer a world of new experiences between the covers. So spruce up your shelves today and buy some of our titles online at monocle.com or from any good bookstore.
It's 23 minutes past midnight if you're listening in Riga, 22:23 here in London. Now, for the first time, Norwegian, the red-nosed bargain airline, has beaten the region's flagship carrier, SAS, in annual passenger numbers. Well, Norwegian's been expanding aggressively over the past few years. So what does this mean for air travel as a whole in the region? Well, Marius Lorentzen is an Oslo-based journalist and regular Monocle 24 contributor, and he joins us now. Welcome to the programme, Marius. Norwegian must be over the moon.
Oh, I'm sure they are over at the headquarters here in Oslo. This is the first time, as you said, that they've passed SAS in annual passenger numbers, even though they have passed them on single occasions in certain months. We saw it back in April last year. They were head-to-head with 2.3 million passengers for the month, and in July in 2015, Norwegian was actually slightly larger in terms of passenger numbers. But this certainly marks sort of step change for Norwegian. But it's also important to note that it's increasingly like comparing apples to oranges now, because Norwegian is expanding so aggressively abroad outside of Scandinavia. So their growth is really coming from their bases in Spain, you know, London, and their long haul operations to the U.S.
We'll do the long haul element in a moment, because it is absolutely remarkable the speed with which and just as you say, the aggressive nature with which Norwegian is pushing. But is there anything that SAS has been doing wrong, or is this just purely one sided due to Norwegian's ambitions?
SAS hasn't really done anything wrong, at least recently. Back in 2012, they were very close to bankruptcy, actually, in some very dramatic days back in 2012. But since that time, they've had quite a remarkable turnaround in the operation. They have a very different strategy than Norwegian. Norwegian wants to have a global operation, and they don't have a home base, so to speak, like SAS does. SAS has their home base here in Scandinavia, with the airline routes in and out of Scandinavia. That's also changing now, as SAS is sort of tackling the competition from the low price airlines like Norwegian and Ryanair. But Norwegian, you know, they're planning on expanding to South America now. They have big operations in the US, and 6 out of 10 routes now never actually go through Norway anymore. So they're actually more of a global company now, really, than a Norwegian company.
It's something that not many people have been that surprised about in coming. I think it is over 5 years, or just about 5 years, since Norwegian said that it was ordering 220 new planes. I mean, we saw this coming, didn't we? Did we not expect it to work quite as dazzlingly well as it has done for Norwegian?
Well, it certainly was a daring move back a few years ago, when Bjørn Sjoste, the CEO, announced that they were ordering 200 planes over from Boeing and Airbus, which was one of the single largest orders I think the airline industry has ever seen. The concern, of course, has been if Norwegian will actually be able to fill all these aircraft, because, you know, you can't just start a new route from a new country. There are a lot of formalities and organizational steps that have to be taken, and marketing efforts and all that. There's also the question of financing all these aircraft. So far, Norwegian has been able to get financing from export financing in the U.S. That's sort of been put on hold, and they've gotten financing through other types of debt in the U.S. and in Europe as well. And they recently launched a new bond in Sweden that was quite successful. But the concern really has been whether they can actually fill these planes, and of course with the financing. So far they've managed that, and therefore it hasn't really been surprising that their passenger numbers have risen. But it remains to be seen if they will be able to keep this pace going. The organization in Norwegian is growing dramatically as well. We just met with the CEO recently, and he told us that, you know, there are 5,000 employees in Norwegian now, and they're adding 2,000 just this year. So it's quite a strenuous effort they're doing over there.
It is astonishing how high that they're punching now. I mean, people are now saying that with this great investment in long-haul budget, they're taking on the likes of British Airways in transatlantic. And in fact, the only great rival that they're coming up against isn't from within airline carriers on this side of the Atlantic. It is, in fact, the likes of Delta Air, which has started to test its no-frills basic economy fare, which is transatlantic. They really are pushing against the whole of the world now, aren't they?
Absolutely. Their long-haul fleet it consists of just over 10 aircraft now, the Boeing Dreamliner, which they launched a few years ago. This will expand to 42 long-haul aircraft in only a couple of years. And you've noticed now, if you start looking at the quarterly results and presentations from other airlines, like you mentioned, Delta, British Airways, and the American carriers, they've actually started to mention Norwegian now as a player in the market. Norwegian themselves actually expect that they'll probably see more actors coming into the market. The American carrier JetBlue is a name that keeps coming up, and we've also seen them engaging in the debate in the U.S. about Norwegian's presence there. So it's plausible that we might see JetBlue launching operations. And there are certainly a lot of players in the market, both in Asia as well as in the U.S. and Europe, who are watching Norwegian. We've seen Ryanair sort of hold back on their long-haul strategy for now. It doesn't seem like they're getting into it anytime soon. It also requires very different aircraft than Ryanair has currently, so We'll see. So it seems likely that they'll get more competition from the US and potentially Asia as well.
Marius Lawrenson in Oslo, thank you for joining us on Monocle 24. It's time now on the Monocle Daily for Tall Stories. It's a weekly feature brought to you by the team who make The Urbanist, a weekly programme dedicated to the cities we live in. The Urbanist, and indeed Tall Stories, takes you on a little journey each week, bringing you a building, bridge or location, or just a feature of a different city each week. Tall Story number 42 takes us on a stroll around London. Around 1,500 gas-powered lamps still burn here, some more than 200 years old. Here to tell us more is Monocle's Bill Lutie.
The recent spell of cold weather here in London has resulted in a number of things. A sturdy new winter coat, handmade to order from a small factory in the north of England. Plenty of warm and hearty soups and casseroles, washed down with a large glass of Barolo. And an uncharacteristic nostalgia for the past. Nostalgia for a time when Londoners went to work and used their hands to get stuff done. And I don't mean sending emails from their smartphones. A time when we fixed things instead of throwing them away. A time when residential terraced streets were filled with thick smog, part cold weather, part industry fumes. When the only light guiding you home was the faint flicker of street lamps glowing through the mist. Yellow and faint, warming and welcoming. The latter was brought on by a recent walk through a cold and foggy Westminster. I was instantly transported back. The air thick with the smell of burnt fossil fuels, visibility reduced to a couple of metres, and any surroundings I could see turned sepia by the glow of tiny and ornate 19th century original gas street lamps. We're not talking the giant white light monsters that line the thousands of miles of highway, high streets or dodgy back streets. These humble beacons have been in place for over 200 years, and they aren't going anywhere soon. Each black post is adorned with the emblem of the monarch in power at the time of installation and topped with one of a number of designs. Some round, some square, all with a little black hat. Overseen by English Heritage, they're fiercely protected and impeccably maintained. Accidents do happen, and although they've been raised a few feet as vehicles have become larger, they still have regular run-ins with London's delivery trucks. If something does get damaged, it has to be replaced with an identical handmade part. This also means that, rather than falling into the category of dying breed, the lamps are on the rise. And that's where the small but specialised troop of British gas engineers comes in. They patrol the streets on Honda 125 scooters, inspecting over 1,500 lamps, which line the Royal Parks, light up Covent Garden, lead the way up to Buckingham Palace and cast their gloomy glow over the walls of the Tower of London. The lamps don't have to be lit by hand. With the invention of electricity, they had to be modernised or risk being replaced. Clockwork mechanisms, and now small battery packs, were installed to automate ignition. These do, however, require a little wind-up every fortnight. One very rare sewer lamp outside the Savoy Hotel was designed with a hollow post which extends down to the sewer, extracts the natural gases, and burns them off before the smell reaches the street. Although it would be easier, cheaper, and probably safer to replace these lamps, the ones that still stand have survived the rise of electricity, the Blitz, and can mostly fend off London's drivers. There's nothing quite like taking a dip into history and pondering what life might have been like in Dickensian London.
Our thanks to Bill Lutie for today's episode of Tall Stories, a Monocle 24 production. To hear the full version of The Urbanist, make sure you tune into the programme on tomorrow at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24. If you miss it, don't worry, go to our website and subscribe or listen through the free Monocle 24 app. We head now to Glasgow, not perhaps the first location to spring to mind when one thinks of the tech giant Apple, but it is in the Scottish city's university that the firm's CEO, Tim Cook, has been awarded an honorary doctorate. And Monocle's tech correspondent, David Phelan, hosted the discussion that followed soon after in front of an audience of 1,000 students, a cosy enough number to be described as a fireside chat. Well, I'm delighted to say that David joins us fresh off the stage now. Well, at least I imagine, David, you've had a couple of hours for everything to calm down, because frankly, I don't know who I feel more excited for, Tim Cook for his honorary doctorate or you for hosting the chat.
yes, I think, well, both of us, it was an exciting event, I have to say. The only disappointment was there wasn't an actual fireside. There was no fire there, but we were sitting in front of, as you say, 1,000+ students. And yeah, it was a great event. Tim Cook is a pretty remarkable CEO, I think, not least because he was open to any question. He made that clear from the beginning, and he answered them in a way that let you know these were questions, topics, ideas that he had thought about long and hard, and nothing was kind of throwaway or off the top of his head. And he spoke out very powerfully. One of the questions I asked was about the immigration ban, and he said we're dead against it. We feel that we have to be active about it. It's the danger in society is when people don't speak up and remain silent in the face of threats. And he said we have to speak out even when our voices shake.
I mean, is there, when you think of a cosy fireside chat, you do get the association with a place and a situation where people can talk openly and frankly. Did Tim Cook mention anything that he and other great tech giants in the United States can do to take on the likes of Donald Trump? Or is everybody still a little bit punch drunk from what's been happening in the last 10 days?
I think, yeah, I get what you're saying about punch drunk, but he seemed very sharp, very considered, and very determined, without trying to directly pick a fight as such, to make clear that he had strongly held values and ethics. I said to him, companies are made up of people, people have values, so shouldn't companies have values? And he said, absolutely, and these are the values we stand for. And he went through a list of diversity and openness and the importance of education and so on. And I think you felt that this was a man who was absolutely ready to take things seriously as a fight if that was what was necessary.
Just thinking about, without any disrespect to Glasgow, one must wonder why Tim Cook has decided to take up an honorary doctorate there, given the fact that one would imagine that it wouldn't be the first university to offer him that. What is the connection?
That's an interesting one. The very first place he visited was Scotland, outside America. I said, what, you mean when you're at Apple? He said, no, when I was an adult. It was the first place he visited outside America. He flew into Glasgow and then went to various places in Scotland. So I think he has a long-term connection. But there are also, earlier today, he went to part of the University of Glasgow that's doing research into how the NHS can be making a difference in terms of personalized solutions to health problems, so that the solution they offered you would be different from mine to someone else's. And he pointed out that this is one of the things that makes this possible is something like Apple's research kit or other ways of analyzing the big data that's around. And he also pointed out that the National Health Service in Britain, in Scotland, is much better able to deal with this data than, for example, American healthcare, where it's a much more transactional system, where it's all about, we'll make you better, but we need to get paid back. The reimbursement was the big thing. So in other words, I think he's savvy about what makes certain things in countries outside the US worth visiting. And yes, there seems to be a long-term connection with Scotland in general.
There also seems to be a very enthusiastic connection with Europe. This is a travelling trip that he's going on, and one French startup has told a newspaper that Apple people contacted them to try to set up a meeting with Tim Cook so he could learn more about French app developers. In the light of not having a president in the United States who has a particularly outward-looking view, should I say, are we looking at Tim Cook as perhaps almost de facto a sort of a liberal voice that will start to be outward looking and maintain a mood that perhaps departed on the 20th of January.
Yes, I think that's really interesting. I think he absolutely is confident in what he believes Apple stands for, and it's not just about selling phones, it's about values and ethics, and certainly about an international approach to things. And he's very confident about putting himself forward as a kind of ambassador for doing that for America, while in the actual White House there are different priorities at the moment.
And finally, the emphasis, by all accounts, is on health within Apple.
Yes, this was a big thing that he talked very passionately about, how, for example, the Apple Watch can track your heart rate. Up until now, it's only athletes who've ever bothered to measure their heart rate. But in fact, the Apple Watch has now already been able to, he says, save some lives, because people have been able to track their heart rate and go into hospital and say, well, I'm not feeling well. Oh, well, we need 2 weeks of health data from your heart. Oh, well, I've got that on my watch, apparently, is the kind of conversation that's been going on, and it has actually saved lives. And he seems to say this is going to be a much more important focus of the company.
David, thank you very much indeed for talking to us. That was Monocle's tech correspondent David Phelan there, fresh off a chat with Apple CEO Tim Cook. You're listening to Monocle 24.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
The time in Beijing is 6:41. Here in London, it's 22:41. Time now for a look at the Asian front pages. Carrying them in rather noisily, Somnath, is Somnath Bhattabhayala, lecturer at SOAS, the University of London, and man in control of all the news. Tell us what's happening. Welcome.
Thank you. Good evening. My first story, which I have got, is about an Indian army man who has vanished, and his army and his relatives have been looking for him, and the army has no response to give. This is because this same gentleman, about a month back, put up a video which went viral about the quality of food being served in the Indian army. Now, he was a whistleblower, and therefore, obviously, being ostracized by the world's fourth largest army. And the main thing to think through here, of course, is, and in a nation which really, really works through scams quite a bit at the press, that hardly anyone spoke about this event at all. It got very, not enough media coverage. And suddenly, we have to remember that India, and the corruption we talk about India, started with the army, the Bofors scandal of the 80s. And since then, the army, the defense deals have always been kind of under the radar. No one talks about it. And this gentleman suddenly brought to us, with evidence, the appalling ways that this people have to live.
This is astonishing stuff. I mean, the fact is, when you look for a picture on this of this man, he's clearly surrounded by snow. So
yes.
This is a man who does not live in the most comfortable of conditions. He's a border security force constable, so he's not exactly the most high-ranking officer.
No, he's not. At the moment, the photograph you see behind he is at the higher. There's no other place in the world which is inhabited higher than this. This is Thras. Not comfortable is to put it very mildly.
Explain to us, therefore. Tell us a little bit about the original complaint that he made. When you say poor quality of food, that is something that you complain about in a restaurant or a hotel. But are we talking about stuff which is genuinely affecting the Indian Army's servicemen and women capacity to actually do their jobs?
Well, within a week after Constable Tej Bahadur put up this video, there was a couple of more videos went up by army constables in different parts of the country. The food quality which Tej Bahadur showed us was appalling. I mean, this was the most watery lentils you could have ever seen, and the chapatis which were provided, which supposedly was the only kind of food they were getting for months on end. While in high altitude, the army gets extra rations and money to provide a much better nourishment than what Tej Bahadur was getting.
Goodness me. Do we know what is thought to have happened to this man? I mean, the fact that there is a... The family are now going to file a habeas corpus petition.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, at the moment, a lot of things immediately happen. First of all, the entire top rank of the army and the border security force came down very heavily on him and on any other soldier who might have done something similar. That was the first thing, which they were disciplined very, very quickly. This fellow filed for a voluntary retirement, which was denied to him, and then he went missing, and there's hardly any conversation. The story has come from Scroll, which is an internet newspaper. None of the major newspapers have printed anything. None of the television companies are talking, news channels are talking about it. And these are so, if it's an India Pakistan conversation, every soldier is praised, and you know the army is every Indian looks up to. But something as serious as this happens, the ranks close.
Goodness me, right. OK, we shall follow that. Mm. Let us move on to scroll.india. A sad story, but nonetheless a light being shone on a very beautiful thing in India. The importance of libraries for very deprived communities. Mm. A very eloquent feature is made on this, is written here. Nonetheless, it highlights a problem that these libraries are no longer being made available to all.
Yeah, I mean, as in most southern economies, especially in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, you would know that public spaces come at a premium. There are hardly any parks, children's playground areas. The rich buy themselves out of it. They go to malls and air-conditioned spaces and get their kids to play. But the poor people, it's the poor who really, really suffer. So, and one of the areas which it really comes to the forefront is education and health. Because the government refuses to spend money on infrastructure, education, health, you see primary healthcare going down. Schools provide very basic or no education at all. And it is here where libraries should have stepped in. The two libraries in question, which are being spoken about here, are both run by private individuals and through donations. Government funding for libraries or spaces like this where young children can meet are very limited, and most of the taxpayers' money, and it's not an insubstantial amount, goes into providing amenities for the middle classes. So the poor kids are therefore being brought into focus with this article.
I mean, it is astonishing when we see so much coverage in the newspapers, in the media as a whole, about the rapid nature of the development in India and the rocket paced rise in economic growth in India. Then you read in this article, like most public schools in the country, teachers are scarce, frequently absent or not interested in students. The curriculum is confused and reading outside rarely encouraged. Why is that still an issue?
I wish I could tell you why this is an issue. But look at this, the other side of it. You know, India is the country where almost every major publishing house from the West are running to. You have all of them there at the moment. Chapman Schuster, Random House, Penguin, HarperCollins, you name it. Amazon in a big way in the publishing world. 500 books come out each month from just the major from the English language publishers, forget the vernacular. And in that country, you do not have spaces where children can read. And this is the sad, this is a sadness. This is the anomaly. I don't know how to explain that the GDP does not reflect the condition of how people survive in the country.
You were mentioning the difficulty of having voices heard in India. Mm. Who is fighting for these children going to libraries?
Well, it's people like Mridula Koshi, who's a writer friend of mine, and other fellow writers, NGOs who work tirelessly. You know, the civil society does do an incredible work where governments fear to tread. So these are the people who are the last vestige of our hopes.
The last vestige of our hopes, indeed. Let us move finally to the Hindustan Times.
I'm sorry about this story. I know you don't like cricket.
It's not that I don't like cricket. Even worse, I have no feelings about cricket whatsoever, which arguably is more damaging. Indifference to cricket is something that you can put on my gravestone. And I know that Andrew Muller of this parish looks at me with an entirely blank face, but such is life. Let's look at the Hindustan Times and the fact that we've just been talking about extreme poverty and lack of opportunity and basic rights for people to read a book, and yet we have accusations that a cricket team is cross because it didn't get a nice enough dinner. Now, in the context of the previous two stories, why have you brought us this on there? It's a Marie Antoinette moment.
No, I mean, let me frame it slightly in a manner which is more deferential to cricket, perhaps. But in the
dinner is dinner.
Dinner is dinner, especially for sports people. No, if we frame the other two stories and this one in the idea of corruption and public money being taken away, the BCCI, which is the Board of Cricket Control in India, is the richest sporting body anywhere in the world.
Tell us what happened here.
Here, the under-19 cricketers.
The national cricketers.
The national cricketers.
Okay, so this is an important team.
Oh, yes, okay. Yes. It's a second-rung team to the senior team,
this
right?
This isn't a local Saturday gang.
No, not okay. at all.
So they need a good dinner.
Yes, and they're playing international cricket and their daily allowance has apparently not turned up. And so therefore, though they stay in five-star hotels, they cannot afford their dinner. It sounds ludicrous that the country's most prosperous sporting body will not play its national-level players their daily money.
I mean, how much money are we talking about here? Are we talking about a chip?
6,500 rupees, that would be
£50.
It should buy you dinner in India. Normally, yes. I mean, the dinners in India are getting more expensive, but yes. But the point being here is slightly different. It just shows how if you leave away the country's top players, the sporting body doesn't want to develop the rest of the gang.
Somnath Bhattabhyal, thank you for telling us tales of divided countries on Monocle 24. Finally today, 42 years since it first hit America's television screens, Saturday Night Live is enduring an astonishing comeback. It is arguably, in no small part, down to this man.
Yes, hello, it's the Donald.
President Trump, how are you? I hear there's been a lot of blowback over your Muslim ban.
No, there wasn't. Everyone loves it. And we had to do it because of that huge massacre at Bowling Green.
I've never heard of that one.
Yeah, it was horrible. So many people died, but actually they're the lucky ones because they don't have to see how bad The Apprentice has gotten.
Well, Mr. Trump, thank you for still accepting our refugees.
Homie, say what?
President Obama said America would accept 1,200 refugees. Your country's compassion will not be forgotten.
No refugees. America first. Australia sucks. Your reef is failing. Prepare to go to war.
Wait.
It would be funny were it not pretty much what happened. That was the biting satire of Alec Baldwin's portrayal of Donald Trump, making the weekend stalwart a fresh hit, not only in the United States, but now across the world. Well, Alison Castle wrote a book called Saturday Night Live, the book published by Tashin, and she joins us now from our New York bureau. There must be a sort of slightly bittersweet element to the fact that, you wrote a book about this show, never perhaps suspecting that its resurgence would be in such unpleasant circumstances.
Well, the show was doing really well when I was writing, doing the book. So when I was doing my research, I've always found it very relevant. So even if the amount of viewers has, fluctuated over the years, I find nothing bad about the fact that it's doing really, really well now. I'm happy for them.
It is absolutely wonderful, and not least for those of us who are not in the United States, who are getting an exciting bit of biting satire plopping into our inbox or to be found easily on the internet. Suddenly, Saturday Night Live is absolutely in the public consciousness, not just in the United States, but around the world.
Mm, definitely.
I mean, how is that? What has been the reaction in the United States to the fact that many of the English-speaking world, indeed many of the Western world, the liberal world, is able to sort of release the anxiety that we're witnessing from across the pond in satire, such as sharp as Saturday Night Live?
Well, satire has always been, for as long as it's existed, it's been what we use to relieve the pain of a troubling reality. And the unique thing I would say about Trump is that you don't have to stretch reality very far to reach a point of really absurd satire. You could just take a lot of what he says and does verbatim and perform it like Alec Baldwin does to laughs. And being able to laugh at something that at other times is troubling somehow relieves its cathartic. We don't have that much else that we can turn to sort of relieve ourselves except collective laughter.
And indeed, it is one of those things that for those who might not wish to follow the activities of Donald Trump so closely anymore, not least because they're pretty exhausting to witness, you get the simplification, you get the policies explained in bite-sized manageable chunks, courtesy of Alec Baldwin, who he himself is enjoying an astonishing moment in the sun.
Mm. Indeed, his performance is legendary as Trump. And Trump himself, we know, watches the show because he often tweets angry comments about Baldwin's portrayal, and says things, he says derogatory things about the show in general and says nobody watches it. But last season, he was actually a guest host, and that was a controversial show, but he hosted the show. So for him to now say that the show is irrelevant and unwatched is pretty hypocritical.
Indeed, it's one of those things that Kellyanne Conway apparently walked out of a meeting with House Republicans after a staffer asked her about the Donald Trump spoof this weekend. Sean Spicer has reacted reasonably honourably to the Melissa McCarthy blistering take on him being a gum-chewing psycho in a press conference. The fact that the White House isn't taking this well makes it all the more fun, doesn't it?
It does. It does. The more someone gets riled up, the more the bully wants to keep going. And I wouldn't characterize SNL as a bully. In fact, they never have historically ever taken political sides. They lampoon politicians from either or any party. But just Trump himself is such, he makes himself such an easy target that the spoof of him just naturally comes out much more flamboyant and extreme than spoofs of some previous presidents.
More seriously, though, before the election of Donald Trump, there's been an accusation, as we sort of examine the ashes of the election, that the press and indeed Saturday Night Live took Donald Trump literally but not seriously, whereas the American electorate took Donald Trump not literally but took him seriously and voted for him. The fact that that satire emerged, many are arguing that actually that contributed to Trump's appeal in many ways.
Well, it's funny because a similar argument was made for George W. Bush getting elected the first time. Will Ferrell played him on the show, and he played him as sort of a benighted, slightly bumbling person who just seemed like a poor nice guy who just didn't really know what he was doing, and he kind of came off as the guy you'd want to have a beer with at the end of the day. You know, you wouldn't mind having a beer with. Let's put it that way, not a bad guy, and. You know, in retrospect, it seems like that might have helped, you know, soften the force of what he was wanting to do politically and might have influenced the election. But to say in this time around that it influenced it, I think is misguided, simply because the electorate that voted for Trump doesn't watch SNL.
Alison Castle, author of Saturday Night Live, the book. Thank you for joining us on Monocle 24. That's all for today's programme. My thanks to our producers, Daniel Giacopelli, and researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Tom Furse. Our studio manager was Antonio Fernandes. The Globalist is here in 8 hours' time, and the Monocle Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Hope you can join me for that. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.